You're listening to Voices of the 99% Occupy DC's Live. You're listening to Voices of the 99% Occupy DC's Live Talk Radio Show. Activists serving the community, working together to empower the voiceless through a collective exchange of knowledge and ideas. Email us, radio@occupydc.org.
Rockets and moonshots, and blame it on the have-nots. Money, we made it. Yeah, but before we see it, they take it. Yes, to make you want to holler at home. The way they do your life, make you want to holler at home.
Good evening. You are listening to Voices of the 99% Radio, and my name is Naveed Nasser. This is Bullet Points. With us this evening is Pete Tucker, independent journalist affiliated with thefightback.org. Pete, are you there?
I am.
Excellent, excellent. So tonight's topic, well, we're going to be touching on a lot of things dealing with local politics, specifically with the D.C. City Council, with the treatment, how can I put it, the selective outrage often exhibited by the Washington Post editorial page directed at certain specific politicians, why that is, why others aren't targeted, and how these campaigns, how these media campaigns affect coverage even of other issues like education, for example. Why don't we start off? I'm going to read a little something from an editorial, an op-ed that the Washington Post published recently about Jim Graham, City Councilman Jim Graham, who represents Ward 1 in the district. The conclusion of the D.C. Board of Ethics and Government Accountability resulted from its preliminary inquiry into Mr. Graham's conduct in 2008 in considering public contracts while on the council and as the city's representative to the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority. The board wrote in a devastating 27-page memorandum that Graham, quote, abandoned his impartiality and demonstrated inappropriate preferential treatment in offering to support a bidder for the city's lottery contract if the bidder would drop out of a separate metro development project. Mr. Graham has consistently denied any wrongdoing. William W. Taylor III, his attorney, released a statement calling the opinion disappointing and unfair and said legal options are under consideration. Mr. Taylor faulted the board for reaching conclusions without doing its own fact-finding. An independent investigation conducted for the Metro Board by an internationally renowned law firm amassed more than 1,800 pages of sworn testimony and documents that provided convincing evidence of Graham's misconduct. And while Graham can't escape, what Graham can't escape is his actions that have again been found indefensible. The ethics board found, quote, substantial reason to believe, unquote, that Mr. Graham violated at least three sections of the D.C. Code of Conduct, giving preferential treatment to any person, losing complete independence or impartiality, and affecting adversely the confidence of the public in the integrity of the government. The best way to begin restoring that confidence would be for Mr. Graham to resign. Now, it's not often that Post calls for politicians, whether locally or nationally, to resign or to be ousted from office. And it's, again, it's very selective in the way that it's done. And I want you to expound on this a little bit, Pete. Why is there a concerted, I didn't even read anything from the most recent op-ed piece, which was also like sort of a call for Phil Mendelson to take up arms against Jim Graham. Why is the Post going after Jim Graham for this? Can you expound on that a little?
Sure. And first, Naveed, let me say thanks for the opportunity to join you, and thanks for the great work that you do on so many issues. The Washington Post, as you said, it goes after certain politicians and not others. Jim Graham's a bit of an exception to the rule. The rule tends to be that in the last couple of years, it's been very stark. Those politicians who are elected by their base of support comes from the African-American community. They are much more likely to find themselves targeted, you know, scrutinized to within an inch of their lives by the Washington Post editorial page, and it spills over into the news pages. And then most disturbingly, well, that's quite disturbing in and of itself, you're frequently seeing the U.S. Attorney's Office follow up on those leads. Now, and we can go into some detail, but with regards to Jim Graham, he's the Ward 1 council member, and he's been there since 1998, and Ward 1 in the District of Columbia is the most populous, most densely populated and diverse ward. Jim Graham is an immigrant from Scotland. Neither of his parents went to high school. He attended Michigan State and University of Michigan Law. He was a chief clerk for Chief Justice Earl Warren and a staff attorney with the U.S. Senate Governmental Affairs Committee for Abe Ribicoff from Connecticut, and served as executive director of Whitman Walker Health Clinic, where he did some groundbreaking HIV and AIDS work. Now, this deal that the Washington Post is highlighting is Jim Graham, in addition to being the Ward 1 council member, served on the Metro, the WMATA board, Metro being the subway and bus system for the region. Includes, you know, Maryland and Virginia. And each of the jurisdictions sends a couple of representatives, and Jim Graham was one of those representatives. And Metro owns some property at 9th and Florida Avenue Northwest, and they had a couple parcels, and they wanted it developed. And one of the developers who got the initial award to develop the property ended up not, Banneker. They are, some of the principals are people who Graham has had some run-ins in the past. And so he was trying to get the contract steered another direction, and then trying to get a friend or a contributor to team up with that, to either get the contract outright or team up with Banneker. He's described this as kind of sharp-elbowed politics. And that's kind of the way that I see it as well. You know, he wanted some, so he wanted the contract to go one way. It went another. But the Metro, I think the Washington Post has done just a series, as you pointed out. It's just been a long-running series. They do this for the people they don't like. They don't do it for those who have their support from the downtown business community. It's something we need to touch on. But they did a series of editorials, and the Metro WMATA followed up and did an $800,000 investigation of Jim Graham. They found that that he violated the code of conduct for Metro, but that he didn't receive any personal money. They didn't. Nothing supported that. They went through 18,000 pages of sworn testimony and documents, and it's just and then the Board of Ethics, the District of Columbia, followed up with a report as well, which just came out, and the Board of Ethics said that there were serious problems, but that since it was just created, this Board of Ethics, they didn't have jurisdiction because the thing went back to a 2008 deal. But they were very concerned with it. Now, all of this, you know, Naveed, in the editorial that you highlighted, you pointed out the last paragraph that said Jim Graham should resign from the D.C. Council. That's the editorial. It says, what he can't escape is that his actions have again been found indefensible. The Ethics Board found substantial reason to believe that Mr. Graham violated at least three sections of the D.C. Code of Conduct, giving preferential treatment to any person, losing complete independence or impartiality, and affecting adversely the confidence of the public in the integrity of government. And again, Mr. Graham denies that he did any wrongdoing. and says that this kind of sharp elbow politics, which you know, I think a strong case can be made. Metro report found differently, not that he violated laws, but that maybe he didn't. He was kind of using his own personal priorities and not the highest standards. And the D.C. Code of Ethics went a little further, the Ethics Board. But if you compare this to the misdeeds of someone who the Washington Post has steadfastly refused to cover, Jack Evans, who is the longest-serving council member as of this week, almost 22 years, and who is his support comes from the downtown business community, and who, in addition to making $125,000 council salary, he earns $190,000 a year on the payroll of Patton Boggs. You go into and
wait, real quick. Can you explain what Patton Boggs is?
Patton Boggs is the largest lobbying firm in the country, as I understand it. It's one of the largest. I think it's the largest, and it represents, you know, it's a who's who of corporate chieftains, and it's and it. I wrote a op-ed in the Washington Post 3 years ago, and I pointed out that Mr. Evans' bio at Patton Boggs, the last sentence read, "Mr. Evans advises clients on real estate matters." After the op-ed came out, he took it down, that sentence. But Jack Evans is chair of, and has been for more than a decade now, chair of the district's Finance and Revenue Committee. And that's not a small matter. He's done, helped put together deals like, a report came out this past week that the public investment for the baseball stadium was, I think it was $936 million is what we'll end up paying, almost approaching $1 billion. Mr. Evans was instrumental in pushing that through. He helped knock down one convention center and build another one to the tune of $850 million taxpayer dollars. And the deal that I want to focus on most for the moment is what's being built as we speak alongside the convention center. And that's a Marriott Marquis, I think three in the world. And this Marriott Marquis is being built on public land and with a public investment of $272 million, more than a quarter of $1 billion public investment. And Mr. Evans is the relevant council member. It's being built kind of by the Shaw neighborhood, almost downtown, and he's the council member for that area. But not only that, as I said, he's chair of the Finance and Revenue Committee. And I went to the groundbreaking and the hearing, and everyone at the groundbreaking, they thank Jack Evans. Thank him for bringing the deal to fruition, and he surely did. I testified just before the deal was voted on, and I asked him if he had any conflicts of interest. That is to say, if any of the participants in the deal were clients of Patton Boggs.
This is 2010 we're talking
Marriott.
About?
It turns out Marriott is not and was not a client of Patton Boggs. But Mr. Evans, interestingly, did not answer my question. He just declined to answer, even though it was, you know, on TV. And then 2 days later, during the committee votes, he just started recusing himself from voting on the deal. Out of nowhere. It was quite shocking.
Pete, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but can you, like, just really quick, give us a time frame. When did all this happen? How far back?
This was 3 years ago.
2010?
Yeah.
Okay. And
I think it was 2010.
From 2010 till now, no one's asked Jack Evans about this. No one's written op-eds about this other than yourself. I mean, do you know of anybody else locally who's dug into this?
Yes. The best reporting has been done by a former Washington Post reporter, John Hanrahan. And
oh, right.
He's been writing in the mail.
That's DC Watch?
In DCWatch.com. But you know, obviously, well, interestingly, he reached out to reporters at the Washington Post and other places because he didn't want it. He wanted a larger outlet and just go ahead. He doesn't have an ego. Go ahead and take it and run with it. and he gave them all the background, and only one reporter even acknowledged receipt of the information. They're just not interested in going after Jack Evans, who has his support coming from the downtown business community, whereas they are hell-bent on going after the elected officials' support comes from the black community.
Now, I want to be fair here, and I want to look at both sides of the ledger. Not with Jack Evans. Not with Jack Evans. I don't think there's anything on the other side.
Can I just finish up with Jack Evans? And then
Absolutely.
Okay. So, Mr. Evans accused himself. By law, you're supposed to file an explanation for why you accuse yourself. Last time I followed, he was just a couple years after the fact. He still had not done so. All that he would say is that he had done so out of an abundance of caution, but he did not file the official recusal, except an email turned up from Mr. Evans' office saying that he recused himself because ING was a partner in this more than $250 million deal, and ING was a client of Patton Boggs's at the time. So Mr. Evans, Jack Evans, who's on the, works for Patton Boggs, structures this whole deal, only recuses himself at the last minute, provides more than $250 million in taxpayer money, and then a major partner in the deal is ING, a client of his firm's. Now, this is all taking place at the same time the council is moving to go after Marion Barry, the former mayor and current Ward 8 council member. And they ended up censuring Marion Barry. And what they censured, which is about the harshest thing the council can do, and the Post just went, like they're doing with Vincent Gray and some of the others, they just went fanatic on Marion Barry. And what he did was that, to read the Post, the council voted 12-0 to censure Barry, strip him of his committee chairmanship, and refer allegations of public corruption to the U.S. Attorney's Office for possible prosecution. The unprecedented sanctions stemmed from an investigation by Washington lawyer Robert Bennett, who concluded that Barry took a cut, a $15,000 contract he awarded to his then-girlfriend. Barry violated conflict of interest rules and impeded the investigation, the report said. So what I was telling reporters at the time was, all right, y'all, Marion Barry is accused of misusing a part of $15,000. What actually, if you read the report, what he did was the girlfriend owed him money, and yet she was on his payroll, and so when she got the check, he wanted what he had given her back. But so let's say he just took all $15,000. No one's accusing him of that. I mean, what's the bigger story here, Marion Barry or Jack Evans doing a deal that, as at the time I said, may, and now we know did, for a quarter plus billion dollars, where a client of his firm is benefiting? And as you go through the press, the fixation is on Marion Barry. There is no attention on Jack Evans. And we can go running up to today, this consistent pattern. Graham doesn't quite fit that pattern, but it nevertheless fits this pattern of the Post targeting certain people who they cannot stand, and then letting others, particularly if they're supported by a downtown business community, they get almost a complete pass, regardless of very serious transgression, not just I think if you're serious about corruption, then you want to apply the principle that, where there's smoke, there may be fire. And if you apply that principle, then you've got to start with Jack Evans' office, because there's more smoke bellowing out of his office than all the others put together. Not just smoke, but as I said, fire. That he did a deal, only recusing himself at the last minute, that benefited a client of his firm. Furthermore, when that deal became ensnarled in legal difficulties, it was reported in the Business Journal and the Washington Post that it was Jack Evans and then Attorney General Peter Nichols who sat down the warring parties and worked out an agreement. So he effectively, he only recused himself kind of technically at the last minute, effectively unrecused himself. This is a deal, again, worth more than $250 million, would benefit a client of his firm. And you can't see that written in the papers, but you can have endless coverage of much more minor transgressions or alleged transgressions.
All right, well, let's lay out some of these names. Let's look at the dichotomy that the Post put in front of us. On the one hand, they have their favorite sons, and we're talking about David Catania, we're talking about Jack Evans, obviously, Adrian Fenty, who was beloved by the Post, Michelle Rhee, like the sun rises and sets with Michelle Rhee as far as the Washington Post is concerned. Those are some of the, again, they're favored local politicians, and Michelle Rhee is a national figure now, of course, but still beloved by the Post and beloved every second that she was here, wreaking havoc on the local public school system. And then on the other hand, we have Kwame Brown, Vince Gray, Marion Barry, Harry Thomas, Michael Brown. Some of these figures have already been taken down, booted from public office for various reasons. Others, the Post is working hard on to get them into the same boat. Again, you've touched upon this. What's the difference here? Why are these people targeted? And I just want to be absolutely clear here. I think I speak for both of us here. It's not that we have a great love or admiration for all these people that we've named. It's just that these public figures, when you dig a little into the private affairs of all of these public figures, these politicians, you're going to find some dirt, right? And it's probably not even going to take that much digging to find a little bit of dirt, right? So why is this? Why is there this selective targeting, again, of some certain individuals and not of others? When, I mean, you yourself have said, I mean, the smoking gun is, I think, there for people who want to take Jack Evans down a notch or two. It's just that no one in any position of importance, certainly no one in any of those big local media, seems to have any interest in doing that. And, again, I know you've spoken on this a little bit, but why is that? Why do we see this, you know, why is David Catania everybody's hero? I mean, if you go back, like, a few years, like the Post coverage of Catania, for example, it's just amazing how much he's portrayed as a saint and a hero and a man of the people and all this stuff. Why do we see this, Pete?
I think you mirrored my sentiment exactly. It's not that the people we're saying are targeted are saints. Some of them have done some things. But why certain council members are so targeted and others, I think has a lot to do with gentrification. I think it has a lot to do with, you know, there are billions of dollars pouring into Washington, D.C., and I think it's probably some of the hottest real estate on the planet Earth. And that money could be used to uplift people or it could be used to uproot them. And one of the biggest impediments to business is the African Americans who are here. And the politicians who are elected by black votes are going to be loyal to their African-American base are a real problem. They're going to ensure that the people who have lived here, who have made this place special, get the jobs, get some chance to benefit and stay. And there's a huge push, literally billions of dollars in investment are pouring in. And who's going to partake in and who's going to benefit from all this? I think that is a huge, I think the Washington Post is not so much, I think they are part and parcel to the gentrification project. You cannot displace this many people. This, it's extraordinary the number of African Americans. D.C. is called Chocolate City. But I was watching a film on GoGo. It was the 20th anniversary of the film. I think the film said it was 72% black D.C. Now it's less than 50% black, barely. But that's an incredible change in the demographics. That is not possible without a story accompanying it. Because if the story was, my God, what's happening, then each development project would be much more scrutinized. There'd be much more attention to whether the people who have been here through the hard times are going to really benefit. But if you have a different narrative being put forward, that development is almost $1 billion for a baseball stadium, and it's $250 million plus for a hotel, and that story takes place, then it encourages the next project and the next project and the next project. So I think that gentrification and the Washington Post is part and parcel to this effort. is very much at the heart of why certain council members get a pass and why certain council members are scrutinized to within an inch of their lives.
I'm glad you mentioned the baseball stadium. I know you've done some work on this. You brought some of this to light. Other folks have too. But I don't know how many people realize that there used to be working-class neighborhoods, working-class African-American neighborhoods, where National Stadium is right now in Southeast. That whole community was gone, and it happened on our dime, on taxpayers' dime. From what I understand, the owners of the Nats didn't put up one dime for the construction of that stadium. Is that right? Is that how I remember it, at least?
I think that's right.
Yeah.
That's my understanding.
It's obscene. I can't bring myself to, I mean, even if they were, a good team, I couldn't bring myself to root for the Nat. It's horrible what goes on in this city. And it's not, unfortunately, even if it was just confined to the borders of this city, it would be horrible. But it's a pattern that we see repeating all over the country: Atlanta, New York, San Francisco, the Bay Area, Chicago. It's happening everywhere, really.
And can I say something about the stadium, which is that if you go to a game and you see the people pouring in, they're from Maryland and Virginia. They're by and large, I would say they're not from the district.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's district taxpayer dollars that are being used, that were used to construct this, again, almost $1 billion. And that $1 billion could be used a lot of ways. I mean, to improve the housing stock, to childcare. I mean, go through the list. There are so many needs. But this money was used, really, I would say, for people from Maryland and Virginia to attend these games. And I suppose they'll say they'll make it up in tax revenue and development and all this. But then who is going to end up owning the land right around it that gets developed? So often it's, again, it's part of this billions of dollars that is pouring in from elsewhere, from all over the country and all over the world. But not, it's too infrequent that you see. And I think, I think Mayor Gray is, and he's been unbelievably targeted by the Washington Post, because you mentioned it, that Adrian Fenty was really the gold standard for the Washington Post, the former mayor, progressive, outgoing, energetic, African-American, gets elected and then just is willing to go just put his foot down, put the pedal to the metal for gentrification, for all these big projects. And Vincent Gray came along, and he defeated Adrian Fenty with a fraction of the money. And the Washington Post has just never forgiven him for that. And they investigated his campaign, scrutinized, and they found a shadow campaign of $250,000 or something like that. And saying the reason he won is because of this, ill-gotten money. But Adrian Fenty had millions of dollars more. And also, I think I don't think you can put a dollar figure on the Post editorial page. And the other media aren't all that different, unfortunately.
No, and the local media was squarely in his camp. They were fully on board with what he did, and he was their poster child. You're absolutely right. It's not just the Post. It's just that the Post was the most, glaring and shameless example of it. But, I mean, I'm not going to name names, but I used to work at a media outlet, and Adrian Fenty was a weekly guest of ours. And he came in, and the hosts of the show would dote all over him. Look at how buff you are, and look how awesome where you your house is, and all this sort of. It was very, how can I put it, very tabloidy, very, very, like, celebrity-ish. I mean, it was just, it's disgusting, a lot of what passes for journalism.
And I don't think you can put a dollar figure on what that media is worth.
Yeah.
And so Vincent Gray had a fraction of the money with no nothing as far as media coverage compared to what Fenty had. He beat Adrian Fenty. Essentially, the African-Americans of Washington, D.C. told the Washington Post and other media to go fly a kite.
Yeah.
And the Post has never forgiven Vincent Gray for that.
And not only have they not forgiven Vincent Gray for that, they haven't forgiven the African-American community for that, and they haven't forgiven the community east of the river for kicking their golden boy out. We really should be going to a break right now, but we are going to come back, and I want to keep how can I put it? Adrian Fenty. There's something about Adrian Fenty that I want to bring into the discussion when we come back from the break. So keep that in mind, and we're going to go to the break, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
The best thing in life is free. You can give it to the birds and bees. I need money. I need money. I need money. Oh, yes, that's what I want. Your love give me such a thrill, but your love don't pay my bills. I need money. I need money. I need money. Oh, yes, that's what I want. Money don't get everything, it's true. What it don't get, I can't use. I need money. I need money. I need money. Oh, yes, that's what I want. A whole lot of money. Money don't get everything, that's true. What it don't get, I don't want. I need money. I need money. I need money. Oh, that's what I want, baby.
This is Voices of the 99%. Follow us on Twitter at OccupyDCLive.
And we're back on Voices of the 99%. You're listening to Bullet Points. My name is Naveed Nasser. Our special guest tonight is local independent journalist Pete Tucker, and his website is thefightback.org. Pete, getting back once again to where we started from Jim Graham, there was an interesting editorial written by Graham's lawyers in the Post a few weeks ago. I want to read just the one portion of it that really stood out for me and really let off the bells in my head. See if you can, agree with me on this. On May 29th, 2008, Graham met with a group led by Warren Williams Jr. that was bidding to receive the D.C. lottery contract. Williams had long been notorious in D.C. affairs for his ownership of Club U, which lost its liquor license after the fatal stabbing of a patron on the dance floor, as well as of an apartment building where tenants repeatedly complained to the district's housing authority about substandard conditions. At the time, Williams was also a principal of Banneker Ventures, a contracting firm that was known for its ties to then-Mayor Adrian Fenty and that was bidding on a WMATA development project in Graham's ward. So I want to ask you, I know this isn't why the case is being brought up against Graham, but I want to ask you, is it possible that part of the Post vendetta against Graham is merely that even Fenty's cronies are off limits?
Yeah, I'm not, the Fenty's, well, first of all, they, those are, and Banneker Ventures was the subject of investigations that were serious and referred to the U.S. Attorney's Office and were the highlight of even post-exposés it got so bad. These folks had their own serious issues. The Graham one confounds me because why the Post is so hateful to Graham. He is one of the more progressive council members. He's not perfect. We can certainly go through ways that he's not perfect. But he doesn't fit the model, which is, if you look at Harry Thomas, it was Ward 5, and and when Thomas really investigated Fenty and his cronies, you're saying, that's when Thomas really got scrutinized, and Thomas had done some stuff. He'd misused, he'd taken a government grant that was supposed to go to children, and he'd used it for personal interest, and he's now in prison. And it's not to say, what he did was wrong. And then they went after Kwame Brown, the former council chairman who resigned. And they didn't even, after years of investigating Kwame Brown, they didn't even get him for public corruption. They got him for inflating his income on a personal loan. I was at court when he was being pleading. And the judge said to the prosecutor, so the bank lost no money? And the prosecutor said, yeah, the bank lost no money because while Kwame Brown inflated his income, he was current on the loan. Not to say, what he did. And any other charge they had against him was that he paid campaign workers like $100 and you're only supposed to allow to pay them $50 or something without – no one, as Kwame Brown pointed out, no one had been, charged with that. It's not to say those things are perfect. They're just – they don't merit the attention that they deserve. Well, Evans and really his stuff really does. And then you have Michael Brown, also elected by his support comes from the black community, and they just ran a series of just editorials and news stories on him. Not that Michael Brown was perfect, but I remember one that just struck me as just being just off the wall, which his license had lapsed, and it wasn't for drinking or anything. It was, I think, unpaid tickets or something. And it was a page A1 story. Now, not front page of the Metro section, front page of the entire newspaper.
Wait. That was what took him down, the fact that his driver's license had expired?
No, they also got him. There were other issues. He had, I think, $100,000 or around, maybe even a little more, from his campaign went missing. And he said that his campaign, it was stolen by his campaign manager, and he also, again, not perfect, he also would put forward the internet gambling effort, which failed, and it turned out the firm he had been working for, because, unfortunately, the way they find D.C. council positions, even though, these are very powerful positions, D.C. is not a state, so outside the mayor, these are the highest elected officials for a $9 billion budget, these are very powerful positions, they should be full-time. But the way they defined it is outside the mayor and council's chairman, you can have part-time work, quote-unquote. They're defining council as part-time. It's anything but. These guys work hard, even if they're, in case that Evans and a few others, maybe not, doing the people's bidding all the time. But they do work hard. And Michael Brown's previous law firm was involved with internet gambling. So they got him for, they really had a campaign against him, and he lost. He's now running again for an at-large seat. But he fits the pattern of if your support comes from the black community, you're going to be targeted, scrutinized into your life. Really what the Washington Post is doing is overthrowing democracy, which is there are too many black votes and too many people who are not okay with just handing the city over to the developers and to the financial interests. And so they can't win at the polls, although sometimes they do, but they can't always win at the polls. And so then they take it to the editorial page and it spills over the news pages. And now you have a U.S. attorney who, it seems to me, his prosecutions pretty closely follow the Washington Post editorials, who they target. And again, they don't go after Evans, but then the Post didn't go after Evans. They do go after, as I said, politicians who support come from the black community. But Graham's an exception. I don't know if they decided they, because people are talking, you know, they're not really saying much in the media, but people in D.C. are talking. Look at this pattern. Why are they only going after certain folks? So I don't know why they've targeted Graham, but they are definitely, he's in their crosshairs, and they definitely want him.
Mm-hmm. One thing that should be noted is they can't, when you say they can't win in the polls, there should be another word added at the end of that sentence, which is yet. As the demographics of the city change, it becomes easier and easier for them to win at the polls. And even to the extent that it's changed now, the last mayoral race between Fenty and Graham was more of a dogfight than it should have been. And it was only as close as it was because there's another pattern that consistently repeats itself whenever there's a local elections, and that is the people who are, how can I put it, most tied into the system, most identify with the system the most, are the ones who consistently end up voting no matter where you are, in which jurisdiction you are. All of them, the majority of them vote, and other people who are on a lower socioeconomic scale, who might feel disaffected, even if they're numerically superior, a lot of times won't go to the polls. It was fortunate that that wasn't quite the case last time. A lot of people, a lot of poor and working class African Americans did turn out to vote, but everybody in the areas of the city where Michelle Rhee went door to door came out to vote. And that's why the numbers were as close as they were. It shouldn't have really been that close. But I digress. There's one thing I did want to say, again, talking about both sides of the ledger here, and Jim Graham specifically, yes, the man, far from a saint. I mean, me and you personally know people who worked on the issue of the Devil's Tower Hotel, as it's euphemistically known, in Adams Morgan, that's going to be constructed, and it's going to... I think that hotel is going to be responsible for the city paper and PFW having to find new digs. Isn't that right, Pete?
That's right. That's right.
Okay. Yeah. So it's the Devil's Tower Hotel. I mean, I've known also.
And that was done with $46 million in
yeah.
tax breaks. Graham actually wanted even 60 plus million in tax breaks, and that is displacing Pacifica Radio's WPFW and City Paper, and will definitely be a game changer for the Adams Morgan neighborhood.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's that. There's there's other things that can't, you know, that are just hearsay that I've heard and that you've heard in terms of business dealings. There's also, I mean, I've been in the room with him where he's like belittled and mocked, you know, friends of mine and things like that right to their face. So, I mean, it's not, again, we're not talking about a saint, but we are talking about someone who, you said, and I agree with this, relatively speaking is more progressive than some of the other council members, and unlike some of the other ones who only listen to the sound of coins, Graham can be swung in the right direction if there's enough of a movement, if there's enough of a groundswell of support, if he can see... The people who are supporting a particular decision, he can go in that way. Some of the other council members, no. It's the only thing that moves them is metaphorical briefcases full of money. And so, I mean, it's like, we're not going to bat, me and you here, we aren't going to bat for Graham. It's just I'm wondering, and you're wondering the same thing, why is it that these people are targeted and not the real sleazeballs, not the ones who are really screwing people over and making money hand over fist while they're doing that, and what the Post is getting out of all of this? It's obvious that the Post is getting some sort of financial, reaping some sort of financial whirlwind from this displacement that's going on in the city, and as a result, they're going after politicians who are put in power by the African-American community and by people east of the river. I mean, at least
yeah.
to me, I thought this.
It's not that, right, it's not that, you know, necessarily going to bat, and as a reporter, I don't think it's my place to support or oppose any candidate. But
right.
when I see folks getting targeted and I see, like, they're putting the dogs on someone, My reaction is not to just walk away. I talked to one, you know, elected official, and he said, yeah, man, you know, basically they're turning the dogs on Gray, so I'm stepping back. And my reaction is different. You know, when I see the dogs let loose, that my reaction is to jump in. And, you know, look, Vincent Gray, we need to talk about education in the Washington Post, and Vincent Gray did a lot of great exposés as council chair, and then it's kind of flipped, and he's closing school, and he's opening up 6 Walmarts. And so I'm not, again, it's not my place as a reporter to support or oppose any candidate, but it's not their place either. And other reporters and, you know, the Post editorial page, but it spills over, are very much picking and choosing favorites. And when they do that, I don't think that, I don't want to just, even I see this amongst activists, like, oh, yeah, well Gray is corrupt. No, Gray is a very serious public servant. And as you said, if you look carefully into any campaign, you're going to find improprieties. They're not going after Gray because he ran a shadow campaign. They're going after Gray because he ran a successful campaign, and he knocked off the corporate wonder boy. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're targeting the man. It's not to say that the other stuff shouldn't be looked into. Sure. But, yeah, I'm not – it's not about defending people, but it's also not about just parroting who they attack. And when they start going after someone – I don't want to just be on the sidelines. I want to point out that I don't think the Washington Post is legitimate as far as an objective source of news. And when they go after someone, I don't want to see them get eaten alive, because really they are overthrowing democracy. The people elected Jim Graham. The people elected Vincent Gray. They elected Kwame Brown. And they elected Michael Brown. And the Post didn't like that, and so now they're trying to use the prosecutor's office to get rid of them, and they have been successful in some instances. And that's just wrong.
Yeah. I think you laid it out brilliantly right there. One of the things I want to talk about with you here in the last few minutes that we have left is the recent wave of school closures that have been announced. And I know that they scaled it back a little. Originally it was 20 schools. Now it's what, 15 schools or 10 schools?
15.
The Post, again, I mentioned it before with Michelle Reed. The Post is far from an impartial, unbiased entity when it comes to this discussion about education in public schools. I know the answer to this question already, and this is a leading question. I'm just telling you this right now, so be prepared for to answer a leading question. Why, Pete, can you explain to everyone who's listening to this, why is the Post not an impartial entity when it comes to the discussion about education and schools? And please include that quote from Donald Graham.
Yeah, Donald Graham is the CEO of the Washington Post, and as he put it, talking to financial folks a couple years back at a time when the revenue for the Washington Post company, more than 50%, was coming in from Kaplan. And Kaplan is a testing company, and they have schools under federal investigation for making commitments to folks that they could get future incomes that are much grander than what they could actually get. But at a time when Kaplan's, with more than 50% of the Washington Post's revenue was coming in from Kaplan, Donald Graham told financial folks, look, I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, but the Washington Post is a, quote, education and media company. Education first. The Washington Post, as a newspaper, makes money, loses money, loses more money. But Kaplan is coming in with a couple of $1 billion. Now they've been hurt because of these investigations, and they basically are a state-sponsored company because they get all these, Stafford loans, but they get through the students, get major federal funding, even though it's questionable what students are getting out of it, and that's why they face investigation. But also Kaplan is a testing company. And look at what Michelle Rhee is about. And she's now taking this, apart from being anti-union, and there's few, I can think of few outlets more anti-union than the Post. But Michelle Rhee, the former schools chancellor, was about testing students, teachers, she could figure out a way, janitors, all the time. Testing, 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 testing. And the Washington Post, Kaplan, it's a testing and education company. And you mentioned that she's a national figure. The Washington Post made her a national figure.
Right.
They just, to an unbelievable extent, truly, it was really just shocking. Editorial after editorial after editorial, news story after news story after news story, just really pushed Michelle Rhee, who's backed by the Walton Foundation. The Walton Foundation, so much so that they wanted to put in, I think that they put in $25 million out of $64.5 million for a radical contract that eviscerated a lot of union rights. That's a, they just gave this money to D.C., to district teachers, because Michelle Rhee was here, and just before the election that Fenty and Michelle Rhee did not win. But that's the kind of money she's backed by. Walton, you know, Gates. These are the people she rolls with. And the Washington Post just promote her, even though, you know, she invested heavily in schools in Upper Northwest and the wider areas. She closed dozens of schools. She really damaged the teachers' union greatly. She was kind of like Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, who a lot of people fighting back against and really calling out. But Michelle Rhee is, she got away with it in a very liberal city, in a very left city. And now if you look who she's teaming up with, she has this organization, Students First. She's teaming up with some of the most right-wing governors throughout the country because her policies are Scott Walker. They are anti-union. They are right-wing. And that makes sense. And that's who the Washington Post put forward. And they put her forward, and the media put her forward so much, just like they did Fenty, but the people didn't. And that's what the election was about. It was the media versus the people, and the people threw them out, and they put Gray in. And as I said, the Washington Post, they have never forgiven Gray. And as you said, they've never forgiven the people for that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a term I'm thinking of with regards to the Post relationship with Kaplan and their stance on education. Do you know what term I'm thinking of here?
No, I do not.
Conflict of interest.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it seems obvious. I know we've talked about this personally in the past, but to me, I mean, it's they need to, every single editorial, every single story that they write, particularly about the D.C. education system, about the D.C. schools, to me, there should be something right in the byline saying, you know, the Washington Post, you know, this is where we make our money. Kaplan, you know, I don't know how many people are aware of this, but everyone who reads the Post, particularly the Post coverage of education and public schools, need to be aware of this. And if the Post itself isn't going to, I know they've disclosed it once. I know for sure.
They disclose it, yeah, not more often than that, but
yeah.
not enough.
Yeah. Yeah. So many people take their cue from the Post. Again, I know of other media outlets, non-print media outlets in their city. The first thing they do in order to decide what stories they're going to cover is what's in the Post. People still consider the Washington Post, national and internationally, to consider its coverage to be trusted, to be valued. I think you're probably in the same boat. I disagree vehemently with that, and I think that there's far more honest dispensers of news and opinion in this area, nationally also. We don't need to rely on the Post to spoon feed us what we need to know, how we're supposed to think. It's not an unbiased entity. It's not. Purely interested in facts. It's got an agenda, several agendas, I guess, that it's pushing, depending on which, what aspect of its coverage you're looking at. But certainly locally, there's an agenda there. And we see it in its coverage of education. We see it in its coverage of housing. We see it in the way different politicians are treated. We see it in the way different communities in the city are treated. We see it in its editorial page. Yeah.
And this might be hypocritical of me to say, but Well, let me just also say that I think maybe as a result of people standing up and pointing this out, they've recently brought on education reporter Emma Brown, who's excellent. And I spoke with her at a town hall briefly. I was like, well, your writing is excellent. Like, where were you writing before that? Before that, she was a teacher. And she's gone from teacher to reporter and is excellent. And you can also get excellent columns from Valerie Strauss, who's one of the best. And I think they get more prominence, and that type of thing can happen when there's public outcry. I mean, the Washington Post is a big institution, and there's a lot of good reporting in the Washington Post. I would actually recommend that people pick up the Post. I know I've spent the whole time slamming it because I do think the editorial page, and I do think it spills over into the news pages, is problematic.
Okay, we got to go. No, I'm just kidding, Pete. No, go ahead.
But I nevertheless think that there is good reporting there. And you know, as far as, like, as a reporter, I want to try and get information. You know, I want to try and, as best, it's hard, but you want to try and get some idea of what's happening. And I come from a newspaper family, so maybe I'm biased, but I like to pick up the paper. I like to read through it, and you get a whole array of different things. And there's a lot of very good reporting. But then there's also, you know, the problematic biases. But I don't mean to, but personally, as a reporter, I find it to be invaluable. But I also find it, you know, there are issues that need to call out as well.
Invaluable and infuriating. Okay, well, since we're playing the on the one hand, on the other hand thing, I'll say that, you know, I read the Post, you know, particular stories, its coverage of this and that, I read it. And yeah, it's both informative and infuriating. And it's infuriating when you see something that's deliberately false and misleading. And on the other hand, you're right, some of its coverage is pretty good. And in terms of, like, okay, now I'm starting to dislike myself for being complimentary towards the Post, so I should stop. But thank you for doing that for me, Pete.
I wanted to hear what you had to say.
Yeah, no, I'm good.
Okay.
I'm not going down that route.
Okay.
Yeah, screw the Post. but okay, so I think this has been a good discussion. I'm glad you came on with us, and I'm glad we talked about some of this stuff. It's frequently not addressed when people are talking about local issues. Why are certain people targeted? Why are certain people brought down? And why are certain people seemingly made out of Teflon and go on, and their careers go on and on and on, even though we know where the conflicts of interest lie, where their dirt is, and it's just, you know, people in positions of power and powerful media just don't seem to care.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Pete, thank you again. Do you have any parting shot, any shout outs, anything you want to put out there?
No, Naveed, I want to thank you very much for the opportunity. I know that you can and do talk very eloquently about any number of issues. I particularly am fascinated listening to you on the Middle East and other international issues. So I know this show could take on any issue, and to spend the hour talking about local D.C. politics, I hope it was worthwhile for listeners. But I do appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. Thank you again for coming on with us. Oh, thefightback.org. We should mention that again. People should definitely check that out. It was updated with a piece this week on development in the West End neighborhood. So please check that out. And I guess that's it. Thank you for being with us again for this hour of Bullet Points with Naveed Nasser. You're listening to Voices of the 99%. And we'll be back again next Friday at 9 p.m.
This has been another broadcast of Voices of the 99%. Tune in again on Friday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. There are no innocent bystanders in life. You have a mind and a voice. Go use them.